The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We were really concerned that if other members of the committee knew about this, then they would be asking different types of questions. But at the same time, it was such a significant issue that if the country involved ever found out that we knew what we knew or what we know, that it would be a major national security issue.
I'm David Chris.
And I'm Nate Jones. And this is the Culper Partners Rule of Law special series on the Lawfare podcast.
In this podcast series, we explore the rule of law, particularly as it relates to U.S. national security and criminal law enforcement.
Today, we are joined by former Senator Saxby Chambliss. Senator Chambliss represented the state of Georgia in the U.S. Senate for two terms. Prior to that, he served four terms in the U.S. House of Representatives, a total of 20 years in Congress. During his tenure in the Senate, he was a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee. He was also on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, where he served as vice chairman from 2011 to 2014. His previous role as chairman of the House Intelligence Subcommittee on Terrorism and Homeland Security made him one of the leading congressional experts on those issues. He is currently a partner at DLA Piper and the chairman of the NSA Advisory Board.
The conversation covers a lot of ground, from the history of the Congressional Intelligence Committees to the significance of election interference and the proper penalties for lying to Congress. Chambliss describes what it's like to serve on the Senate Intelligence Committee. He even mentions a particular situation, apparently still classified and undisclosed, that is so significant that if the country involved ever finds out what we know, the result will apparently cost American lives. Senator Chambliss seems most of all to lament the loss of professional and personal relationships across political lines, and he wants to stand up strongly for the hardworking women and men of the U.S. intelligence community. And in a show of true bipartisanship, he also tells us that Ted Kennedy was the best legislator he ever knew.
It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 402, Senator Saxby Chambliss on the Rule of Law.
So, Senator Chambliss, thank you very much for being here, and welcome to the Culper Partners Rule of Law Podcast.
Well, thanks, David. It's always good to be with you, and thanks for generating a discussion on the rule of law and continuing to do the great work that you have always done in the realm of national security.
Thank you. During your 20 years in the U.S. Congress, did you feel as if the rule of law was sort of a foregone conclusion in the United States, or was it instead something you really felt the country had to renew and regenerate and work at? And if so, did you feel like you had an obligation to live up to that ideal?
Well, I think if you went to all 535 members of Congress and said, do you believe in the rule of law, you're going to get 100% affirmative responses to that. But I think
what do they mean by it, though?
Here, I'm sorry?
What do they mean by it when they all say yes?
That's the twist. I mean, it's when you have a set of facts that you have to apply the rule of law to, is where the disagreement comes in as to whether or not this is an issue where the rule of law says you shall do so and so. And I think that there's some examples that occurred to me as I think about or thought about this.
Yeah.
You know, from impeachment House of Representatives, which occurred while I was there. Wow. In the impeachment process of Bill Clinton, even though everybody agrees with the fact that the rule of law is what we should go by, Democrats argued that this was not an issue where the rule of law should be applicable because it was not a criminal offense. And Republicans argued, obviously, just the opposite. I think the encouraging thing from a U.S. perspective around the world is that we had four charges against President Clinton from an impeachment standpoint. Republicans voted, for the most part, for two of those, and some Republicans, along with 100% of the Democrats, voted against two. Mm-hmm. So the rule of law worked in the way that the rule of law should work. So I do think that it is a general foregone conclusion that, yes, the rule of law is applicable to our civilian and our political life. But then you get into the politics of it when you have the political facts that are involved.
Yeah, and that impeachment example, I guess, if it didn't line up 100% Republican-Democrat, shows that people were being moved by something other than just straight party affiliation. Tell me some of the other ways you think Congress is set up, either formally or informally, with the committee structures or as I say, even informal mechanisms to ensure that rule of law is upheld. What are some of the ways that gets done in Congress?
Well, obviously, we have a committee system structure in both the House and the Senate, and one of the most important committees in both bodies is the Judiciary Committee, and that's where the jurisdiction for the rule of law, for the most part, applies. The Judiciary Committee in the House, as well as the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, are the two most partisan committees in those respective bodies. That being said, there's an awful lot of bipartisan activity in the way of the way the rule of law is approached from a legislative standpoint. So while you can have disagreements about policy, at the end of the day, because we have that committee structure and because those respective committees are charged with the responsibility of ensuring that the rule of law applies to our everyday life, they're two of the most respected committees that we have, and they're two of the committees that are listened to with a great deal of respect by other members of Congress when it comes to dealing with legislation that comes out of those committees.
Mm-hmm. You know, do you think sometimes Republicans and Democrats in the Senate sort of come together, or in the House come together, to sort of gang up on the executive branch? That's certainly been the perspective of certain members of the executive branch from time to time. We had John Brennan on this podcast recently, and he described a very contentious period with the Senate Intelligence Committee Democrats when he himself had been appointed by Democratic President Barack Obama. And I know you were present for that. I mean, do the lineups ever sort of go out of whack for, you know, institutional separation of powers reasons?
That's kind of the nature of the world of intelligence. During that process, John did get sideways with the Democratic members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and as vice chairman, I became his best friend because I happen to think John was right in his approach to the issue that got him in that sideways position. And there were times when Republicans, from a national security as well as an intelligence perspective, disagreed in a big way with President Bush, particularly over some of the issues surrounding Iraq. So it can happen. Most of the time, I would say that Republicans would support a Republican in the White House and the Democrats likewise. But at the end of the day, there are some situations that can develop that puts Democrats opposed to a Democratic president in likewise Republicans.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about how these intelligence committees came to be. You were the vice chair on Senate Intel and previously in House. I mean, tell us a little bit about how they came into existence and what is it that they're really supposed to do that is so special?
Well, I was fortunate to serve on the House Intel Committee my last 2 years in the House and then on the Senate Intel Committee all 12 years. So I had 14 years straight of serving on the Intelligence Committee. And early on, David, I wanted to make sure I knew the history of the committee because if I was going to do my job, I like to know the background of what it is that we're going to be asked to do. And the history on the Intel committees is a lot more interesting than the history of other committees, some of which date back to the early years of Congress and in the late 1700s and early 1800s. The intelligence committees are a product of some situations within the intelligence community where we had an overreach by agencies into the personal lives of American citizens. And during the mid-70s, all of that came to light as a result of several different situations that became public. And when the Church Commission, which was a Senate commission, and it was one of several different commissions that were put in place at the same time back then in the mid-70s, did their investigation, they found some real significant violations of the Constitution relative to the Fourth Amendment that were being carried out by some members of the intelligence community. There was no oversight of those agencies by Congress, by specific committee at that time. So that's when the intelligence committees were created in both the House and the Senate, the mid-70s, which really isn't that long ago. But the committees themselves are a little bit different in the structure compared to other committees in that, for example, on the Senate side, the makeup of the Senate Intel Committee is 15 members. It does not matter how many Republicans or Democrats are elected to the Senate. Doesn't matter who's in the majority. You're going to have 15 members. You're going to have 8 of the majority party and 7 of the minority party in the Senate. Whereas on other committees, the ratios vary depending on the margin of the majority in the Senate. So, and the other thing that is different by design about the Senate Intelligence Committee is that you don't have a chairman and a ranking member like you have on every other committee. You have a chairman and a vice chairman. So I was vice chairman to then Chairman Feinstein for my last 4 years. And what that basically meant was that we were co-equal. She ran the hearings, but in her absence, I ran the hearings. That doesn't happen in other committees. The next in line on the majority side runs hearings. She could not hire or fire anybody without my consent, and me likewise. We shared the authorities, both from a budgetary standpoint as well as a day-to-day operation. The House is a little bit different, and we probably want to talk in a little more detail about what has happened with respect to the House Intelligence Committee over the last couple of years. And I say it's different because it has always been much more partisan than the Senate Intelligence Committee. Now, we had members of the Senate committee that on particular issues such as privacy or maybe on the enhanced interrogation issue, we would have disagreements and we would have serious divisions within the committee. But for the most part, on the issues that we normally dealt with, i.e. terrorism, both domestic and foreign, the the gathering of intelligence and the way we gather intelligence, we pretty much were all on the same page. And we could have disagreements about some aspects of a program, but for the most part, we all agreed that at the end of the day, the most important thing is that we have to make sure that our men and women who are responsible for gathering the intelligence to make America safe and secure have the tools they need to work with to do the very best job that they can within the realm and restrictions of the Constitution.
Yeah. Senator, this is Nate. Since you raised the HPSI issue, we might as well go right to it and talk about it a little bit. You know, you talked a little bit about the institutional protections to maintain a level of bipartisanship that exists on the Senate side. On the House side, we've seen things, I guess some people think we've seen things go off the rails a little bit. And I guess one question is, do you think that's attributable to the lack of those institutional protections, or does it also require individuals to work at maintaining that kind of relationship?
I think it's kind of a combination of all of the above. What I quickly observed as somebody who is still engaged with the intelligence community about what happened on the House side was that personalities got involved, and there was a real an issue between the leadership of the committee on both sides, and when that happens, there usually is not going to be a very good result. And I think that's what we have seen when the Russian situation developed. I had a conversation with both Senator Warner and Senator Burr, who were then obviously chairman and ranking chairman and vice chairman of the Senate Intel Committee, and it pleased me to no end to hear them talk separately as well as together about the fact that this would probably be the most serious issue that they would be involved in during their tenure in the Senate. Because interfering with something as basic to America as our election process is no doubt one of the most serious issues that any member of the Senate or the House could deal with. And what both of them told me was that we're not sure where we're going on this, but we're joined at the hip. We're going to do all of the investigating together. There's not going to be any Republican hearings and Democratic hearings. And most importantly, at the end of the day, we're going to produce a product that is a meaningful product, but is a product that both of us are going to be able to sign off on. That didn't happen on the House side. And when Chairman Nunes, for whatever reason, made his trip to the White House, where he apparently was handed some documents or something and sort of got off track, or as you say, Nate, off the rails, they were never able to get back on the rail. And because of that, the Senate Intel Committee was immediately perceived, and I think correctly so, to be the real adults in the room, and ultimately the HPSI has pretty much become irrelevant on the issue that is the number one issue still facing certainly the electoral process, which is the foundation of our democracy.
Yeah. I guess one other follow-up question on that. Is the change of power in the House an opportunity to push the reset button on HPSI, or is there some other way to have some adults in the House intervene to repair that relationship? What's your sense?
You're still going to have the same players in the game.
Yeah.
And all you're going to have is you're going to have the Democrats in charge versus the Republicans in charge. And I think the Democrats have an opportunity to show real leadership. I hope they do, and that they can restore relevancy to that committee, because it is so important. Likewise, I think it's going to require reciprocation on the part of Republicans to realize that they're not in power, which means that they're not going to be able to go in the direction which they've gone in for the last couple of years. And if both sides will agree to that and both sides will exhibit really good leadership, I think there is the opportunity to get their house back in order. But if they just say, well, you guys did thus and so during the last 2 years, and we're going to go just as far in the other direction, then you're going to see a splinter continue on that committee.
Yeah. You know, tell us, maybe you can give Congressman Schiff and Congressman Nunes some advice. I mean, you had a reputation when you were there as a very bipartisan senator, friendly to both sides of the aisle. You've mentioned Senators Feinstein and Warner in this podcast and in your farewell speech. I believe you went out of your way to praise both of them based on your time there. So how do you do it? Because, you know, you were able to maintain good relations with them, but at the same time, I don't think anybody would accuse you of, you know, pulling your punches on the genuine policy differences that agreed. So how did you manage that? What are the lessons that others could maybe draw from that in order to get things back on the rails?
Well, first of all, the Senate has always been a congenial body. It's designed to be a little bit different from the House, and that the framers of the Constitution designed the House to be hard-charging and frankly, more partisan than the Senate. And, you know, everybody's familiar with all the conversations between Washington and Jefferson relative to that particular issue. So it goes way back. But on the Senate side, you get to spend more time with individual members simply because there are 435 members of the House and there are 100 members of the Senate. So just the nature of that being what it is, you spend more time with Democrats and you spend more time with folks on your side of the aisle too, but you become friends. And both Warner and Feinstein still are my good friends. And I enjoyed working with them. We didn't always agree on everything, but we could disagree respectfully. And Republicans don't have a patent on all the good ideas, and certainly the Democrats don't. And what the Senate has always been designed to do is to take the best of both sides and find that sweet spot that is the best result, rather than having a piece of legislation which is 51-0 with 51 Democrats and no Republicans or vice versa.
Yeah.
We've seen some examples of that happening over the last several years, Obamacare being one. I think if President Obama had listened to the Republicans, that piece of legislation would have been a much better piece of legislation for the long run. Likewise, I think the tax package that President Trump had passed, if he had worked with the Democrats and gotten Democratic votes for some of the provisions, I think it would have been a much better piece of legislation. So you pick your fights, but if you do so in a respectful way, you gain, and then hopefully you're able to keep the respect of folks across the other side of the aisle. And in the Senate, you have to have them because there's still times when you got to have 60 votes. And it was important to me to have personal relationships in addition to just policy relationships where I could work with people, and that made it fun.
Yeah.
It's no fun to get up every morning and think, well, golly, what am I going to do to Democrat, make Democrats' life miserable today? that's not a very good attitude to take to work every morning.
Yes, although one does have the feeling sometimes that people in both parties are actually waking up in the morning and going to bed at night and thinking nothing other than that in between those two times. So,
yeah, unfortunately, that's right.
I think that, you know, it's funny David mentions that, because I think, you know, there is a perception among the general public, it seems, that the partisanship in Congress, including in the Senate, has gotten worse over the years. Was that your experience while you were serving there? Do you think it's gotten worse since you left?
It got gradually worse during my 12 years in the Senate. I had my first 2 years in the Senate, for example, I was on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I chaired the subcommittee on immigration. commission. My ranking member was Ted Kennedy. And I came back to Georgia and campaigned on the fact that I worked very closely with Ted Kennedy to get some immigration legislation passed. I would not have been reelected. But Ted Kennedy was the best legislator I have ever seen. And I learned a lot from him. And what I learned from him was that if you want to have a good piece of legislation at the end of the day, you work with your colleague on the other side of the aisle to ensure that you get what you want, but at the same time, you're going to have to give up something. That word compromise is a four-letter word in Washington today, but that's the way the Senate works.
Yeah.
And it works best when that compromise is injected into the legislative process.
Right. So should they return to regular order and a broader application of the 60-vote rule? Would that help the Senate fulfill its historic, you know, sort of mediating function?
The 60-vote rule has always been the kind of the saving grace and the salvation of the Senate. It keeps civility and reason within the legislative process. And I thought when Harry Reid made the decision to go to 51 votes on the executive calendar, with the exception of Supreme Court justices in 2013, that was a terrible decision, and I thought the Democrats would live to regret it. I thought when Mitch McConnell reduced the 60-vote requirement to 51 on Supreme Court nominees, I thought exactly the same thing. I think those were bad moves, and I wish there were some way to get back to the 60-vote rule.
It seems hard to imagine that anybody who has 51 votes is going to, in the present, vote to raise the number to 60. Is there some way that we could, you know, agree that, say, 12 years from now, no matter who's in power, we're going to revert to 60 votes? Is there some, like, you know, legislative trick like that that might do the deal for us, or is it just hopeless?
That makes sense, and you're right. And nobody who's in the majority today is going to say, "Yeah, I want to." We're going to mandate 60 votes versus 51. I mean, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And a resolution of it could be putting it far out there into the future, like you say, and seeing irrespective of who's in control of the House, the Senate, or the White House. This rule is going to come back into play on a date certain.
Yeah.
There's a lot of conversation now among Democrats that if we ever retake control, we ought to think about doing that. Well, you're not going to get elected majority leader in the Senate by campaigning on that platform, I can assure you.
Okay, so Nate and I will not be holding our breath for this to get fixed. Sounds like
not in short term. But let's shift gears a little bit and talk about interactions with the executive branch. You know, especially with the Intelligence Committee, you know, one of the core legal obligations the executive branch has is to keep the committees of the House and Senate fully and currently informed. And the statute doesn't have a asterisk, but I think it's pretty well understood that that has some limitations or exceptions. You have a great deal of experience, I assume, with the executive branch's interpretation of where those exceptions are appropriate and why. Did you find their arguments to be compelling? Can you tell our listeners how you resolve differences of opinion?
Well, there is a requirement that that the entire Senate be kept abreast of national security matters. There's specific language, as you indicate, which says that members of the Intelligence Committee shall be fully informed of all intelligence issues. The way the interpretation of that has evolved is, and I think correctly so, that there are certain leadership positions within the House and the Senate where those leaders, i.e. of the House and Senate themselves, the Speaker and the Minority Leader on the House side and the Majority Leader and Minority Leader on the Senate side, as well as the ranking member of the intelligence committees are to be kept fully informed in a different way from other members of even the intelligence committee. And by that, I mean, there are certain things that are ongoing within the realm of national security where you can't afford to, you can't afford the risk of any leaks taking place. And we all know that Washington is the town that leaks the most, and not into the Potomac. So, it has evolved in, I think, a good way. We had what was called the Big Eight, which were four leadership positions that received briefings at a different level from the remainder of the committee. Diane and I made some conscious decisions from time to time that other members of the committee should also hear the same briefing. And we never got turned down. We had some arguments with the executive branch from time to time about the extent of what they should be told. But an example of that is Leon Panetta was the director at the CIA when I became vice chairman. And he called me up. He actually knew before I was officially named. He knew before I knew. So I knew that he was running the best intelligence agency in the world. But he called me up on a Sunday night, and he said, "You and I need to meet tomorrow. There's something I need to brief you on." Well, I had been on the committee for 8 years, and I thought I was pretty well informed, but I found out right quick that there were a lot of other things that I was never told about, but all of a sudden was going to be told about. And what he had reference to at that time was the fact that we were observing an individual in Abbottabad that we thought was Osama bin Laden.
Yeah.
And that was in January, and then, of course, we ultimately came to the conclusion that was him, and we got briefings on a regular weekly basis after that. At my level, nobody on the committee knew that those observations were taking place. There are things like that where you just can't afford to run the risk of the broad population being fully informed. There were some occasions, I don't remember you being involved in any of the particular discussions, but
that's good.
But back during the Bush years, when we had the interrogation program underway, part of our obligation was to make sure that the individuals who were running every program were doing it under the appropriate authority, and we had a real debate with the Bush White House over the review of the memos granting the authority for the detention interrogation program. So there are times when you really butt heads with the administration over issues, and you know there's some of that going on right now with the fact that Republican committees in the House have subpoenaed documents from the FBI that they refuse to turn over. And they're just not going to do it, and they're going to win those arguments because they think it's within the realm of their jurisdiction to decide when there's a risk of leakage of something that could really, really cause a loss of American lives.
Yeah. And, you know, the Gang of Eight is a pretty small group, I would say. You know, in the context of the interrogation program, one of the things that came out there was Senator Rockefeller, who was on the Intelligence Committee at the time and part of the Gang of Eight, had expressed concern in the early days about the limitation of the disclosure to the Gang of Eight, and among other things, said he felt constrained by not being able to talk to other members or staff, and that it was particularly limiting at times in your ability to conduct vigorous oversight.
Yeah, Yeah, there are times when I did feel that way. There's one particular situation that is yet to be disclosed that I was privy to and was briefed regularly on that really caused Diane and I great concern going forward because of the particular country that was involved and the nature of the issue. We were really concerned that if other members of the committee knew about this, then they would be asking different types of questions. But at the same time, it was such a significant issue that if the country involved ever found out that we knew what we knew or what we know, that it would be a major national security issue that, again, could cost American lives. And you can't afford to run that risk.
Yeah. And when you had disagreements with the executive branch over those kinds of things, as you said, it's ultimately often up to the executive branch to make a decision about what can be disclosed to who. Did you feel like you were in a well positioned, I guess, to judge whether their limitations were appropriate?
Well, we would make the argument. I knew at the end of the day, as Diane knew, that it was going to be their call, whether it was the Bush administration or the Obama administration. They were the ones that were going to ultimately be the decision maker. But if we felt strongly about it, we didn't hesitate to go to all the way to the Oval Office to say you really ought to think about disclosing this. And there were times that we prevailed. Most of the time we didn't. But, you know, that's why the president's president.
Yeah, to I guess put a finer point on it, we saw, again, in the case of the House, where they actually moved forward with their own process to declassify information. It sounds like, you know, at the end of the day, you regularly deferred to the executive branch's judgment on that and would push it as far as you could, but ultimately would resign to it. And I'm wondering if you have any perspective on whether and under what circumstances it might be appropriate for the Congress to go ahead and overrule the executive branch in that kind of way.
I can't remember a specific instance that where I can say that I think they should have been overruled. Some of them are very borderline. Obviously, there is a situation in existence now relative to the transparency of the FISA court. Mm-hmm. David was very involved in work on the FISA court, and I still today feel like that there are some things that are classified that should remain classified that the general public does not need to know about. And we had that argument relative to the FISA Accord, and Chairman Nunez actually released some documents from the FISA Accord that were classified documents. And again, you have the, and I say he released classified documents. I probably stand to be corrected on that. But any documents coming from the FISA court are not authorized for release, be they classified or not. But
I mean, let's talk
the administration,
about
for the most part, whether it's Republican or Democrat, I think have used good judgment in the when we did have those arguments about whether or not to release something.
Yeah. Can I just follow on that, the Nunez FISA, because it is the first time that we've seen in public portions of a FISA application, the application on Carter Page. Are you worried that this unprecedented event will have some long-term bad effect on the FISA program?
I do worry about that because you got a precedent that's been set out there now.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, there's nothing to keep any member of the Intelligence Committee who is familiar with the FISA process to go out on any major network and on Sunday morning and all of a sudden start talking about something within the FISA court that they've been briefed on And that's just not the way that court was designed to work, and it's not the way that the world of classified documents in intelligence world should work. So, yeah, that does concern me that can happen.
And sort of taking that as a little bit of a case study, one of the things that has struck us, I think, is, you know, the legislative branch and the executive branch were set up in some ways to fight over issues like this from time to time. What's a little strange about right now is that, as you pointed out earlier, you've got the FBI and DOJ sort of trying to hold the line on not disclosing investigative documents and following the standards in the so-called Linder letter about not briefing Congress about ongoing investigations and not disclosing informant names and so forth. But instead of a straight-out fight between the executive branch and Congress, with the president and the agencies lined up on one side and the committees on the other, you've sort of got a mix here with, it seems like, the president taking the side of some people in Congress, including Chairman Nunes, against his own agencies within the executive branch. What do you make of that sort of slightly unusual alignment? And do you think our system was really designed to accommodate that kind of a lineup in these areas?
Well, there are a lot of strange things that have happened within the intel world over the last couple of years. And I was surprised that President Trump didn't really take the intelligence community early on for what it is, which is the very best organization at gathering intelligence that there is in the world. And they do it with professionals who do it in a professional way. And as the Commander-in-Chief of the United States, he's the most powerful man in the world, primarily because he has the benefit of that intelligence. And those people are on his side, and he needs to encourage the community and not be critical.
He doesn't seem to understand or act as if they're on his side. At least if you listen to him, I mean, he really seems to respond to the IC as almost an adversary in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well, you alluded to the situation where he kind of took the opposing side of DOJ and the FBI on some of these issues, and obviously he hasn't hesitated to be critical. And being critical when criticism is justified or warranted is okay.
Yeah.
But the intelligence community operates in just a different sphere than any other agency within the government. And there, the criticism of the intelligence community, for the most part, should be done just like the gathering of intelligence, which is, you know, for the most part, behind closed doors and not in the public realm. And that's more of a personal opinion rather than a political requirement, I guess.
But it certainly makes it less political when it is done that way.
During the Obama administration and the Bush administration, there were debates over a variety of things, from surveillance authorities to interrogation techniques to how you handle and prosecute captured terrorists. And I guess the first question I had is, you know, particularly during the Bush administration, one of the arguments that they were making at the time is that the executive branch, in the context of an armed conflict, could ignore certain statutory restrictions or interpret them creatively. And at least in the context of interrogation and military commissions and surveillance, Congress actually stepped in, did some investigations and oversight, and ultimately legislated. You mentioned earlier that you had some agreements and some disagreements with the Bush administration's policies. I'm wondering if you felt it was important for Congress to at least legislate in those areas, regardless of what you felt about the policy, just to protect certain institutional interests that they have in asserting the need to abide by the rule of law, so to speak.
Sure, that's a role of Congress. Congress has an obligation to ensure that tools are granted to the intelligence community, but that those tools are well within the constraints of the Constitution And if you don't do that, then there tends to be opportunities, and those opportunities taken advantage of to go around the constitutional protections that are granted. So I think very clearly that's a role that Congress needs to engage in. And what people often tend to forget, and there are a lot of people who are even arguing today who weren't old enough then to really appreciate the situation that the country was in and the situation that the Bush administration was in, which is, we suffered an attack on September 11 like we've never suffered in the history of our country. Maybe Pearl Harbor could be compared to it in some ways, but this was in the heart of America.
Yeah.
And as we recall, there was the concern within the intelligence community that the next wave was coming, and the president had to make decisions based on the best information that he had, the best intelligence that he had, to do certain things in order to protect America and Americans. And, you know, if he, looking at it with hindsight, would he have given authorities or mandates to some areas of the intelligence community? Probably not, but we didn't know that.
Yeah.
And so what Bush did and what Obama has done, or what Obama did to a certain extent too, was to make sure that those tools were in the toolbox. And I do think that constitutional restraints have always been a factor in the mind of both those administrations as well as the current administration relative to intelligence gathering and the use of tools. But when Americans are afraid, Americans tend to allow some variances on the fringe of those guarantees, and I think that's what we saw happened. And it was the role of Congress to step in and say, "Okay, we're gonna do this. We're gonna allow it, but it's got to be within certain bounds." And unfortunately, in my opinion, the further we get away from September 11, the looser those bounds get.
Just yesterday, Michael Cohen, the president's former attorney, pled guilty to lying to Congress. In the last 24 hours or so, we've heard some folks downplaying that a bit, saying it's a process crime and not a very big deal. But just today, Senator Burr was speaking at a conference in Austin, Texas, and he revealed that the Senate Intelligence Committee has actually referred a number of cases to the special counsel's office for based on suspicion that they've misled Congress in some way. You know, as a former member of the House of Representatives and the Senate and the intelligence committees, how serious do you take allegations of perjury before Congress? Is it something that you find deeply troubling?
I do, especially something like this, where there was no rhyme or reason in looking with hindsight as to why he would go to Congress and not tell the truth about this particular issue. But it doesn't matter what the issue is. If you come in and you don't tell the truth to Congress, then it should be treated very seriously. And I hope he receives a very stiff sentence. Otherwise, you're sending a message, and it would be the wrong message.
Yeah.
We all know of situations where people in even a lesser environment have not told the truth to the FBI, and they've gone to prison because that proved to be a lie.
Mm-hmm.
So when you come to Congress and you intentionally lie, it should be treated very, very seriously.
All right. Thank you for that. And with that, I think we'll let you off the hot seat. So,
yeah, Senator Chambliss, thank you very much for joining us on the Culpert Partners Rule of Law podcast. It's been a real pleasure.
Okay, guys. Enjoy being with you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you haven't yet,
Please share the Lawfare podcast on social media and give us a rating and review wherever you listen to us. The Lawfare podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.